talks about ideas like alternative facts. I never did a story for Marketplace that was accused of bias or of being partial or unethical. This was more of a big picture discussion that I wanted to carry on with other journalists. That discussion is going on now, and I'm really happy to see that that's happening. And I think that the sad thing has been learning from a lot of other journalists around the country that they're afraid to raise these questions, and in particular, journalists of color or transgender journalists who are in newsrooms that are mostly white, where journalistic decisions are being made from sort of a certain perspective, and we're all aware that that perspective affects how we cover stories. We should cover them truthfully, we should cover them fairly, but I still think we should be questioning kind of the meaning of neutrality in this time, and a lot of people want to have that conversation, and they shouldn't have to be afraid to have it.
Well, we're going to continue the conversation after the show, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Our guest, Lewis Wallace, fired from the national radio outlet Marketplace on Monday after posting on his personal blog about journalistic neutrality and the challenges of being a transgender journalist in this era of alternative facts. That does it for our show. We'll also link to his piece. Very happy birthday to Hugh Grant. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guster, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Pruitt. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Ontario Power Generation, OPG, is determined to build an underground storage bunker for nuclear waste less than a mile from Lake Huron.
And we're going to hear about that in just a few moments, because we have to officially get started with our public access, public affairs news show, and it's called the new WHFR Journal. Let's hear that theme, folks. It's WHFR Dearborn. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn, Michigan, and the surrounding areas. My name is Jay Koronek, station advisor here at WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and we're happy to be with you today. Of course, it is one day after Groundhog Day, so that's our top story. Hey, we do important stuff here, folks. Punxsutawney Phil has predicted more winter weather. You probably got this because I'm sure it was a top story on all the commercial stations, because it's so important that a groundhog tells us that we're going to have or not have 6 more weeks of winter. And the way that goes is, first of all, Punxsutawney Phil is in Pennsylvania, and he is certainly Pennsylvania's most famous groundhog. I mean, can you think of any other Pennsylvania groundhog by name? I don't think so. Anyway, yesterday morning he saw his shadow. And what that means, and it'd be very interesting to get into some of these folk stories, these legends, myths, whatever, is that there's going to be at least 6 more weeks of winter weather coming up. And, of course, it doesn't make any sense to yours truly, as most myths and legends and many other general statements do, because if you look more closely at it, if it's sunny and the groundhog sees his shadow, that would seem to be an omen or a sign that weather is getting better. It's not continuously cloudy, stormy, dark, right? So it would seem to me, if you can't see his shadow, then we might have more bad weather. It might still continue. But if it's sunny, that means maybe the weather is breaking and the winter is, you know, going away. And, well, anyway, the story actually, thank you, Associated Press, goes on to say that these Groundhog Day festivities didn't originate in Pennsylvania. They originated first in a German legend that states if a furry rodent, and I guess a groundhog is a rodent, I don't know, I hate to insult him if he isn't, cast a shadow on February 2nd, winter continues. If not, spring comes early. And again, I think it's backwards. I think somebody got that backwards. Now, Punxsutawney is located around 65 miles northeast of Pittsburgh, in case you wondered. That's why his first name is Punxsutawney Phil. And records dating to 1887 show that Phil has predicted more winter 103 times, while forecasting an early spring just 18 times, including last year. And now there's no records for the remaining years, the report said, out of that all the years since 1887. So generally, he forecast more winter. And technically, folks, winter doesn't end until March 21st or 22nd. So technically, he's probably right. You know, there's no doubt about it. Officially, winter was not going to end until after March 21st or 22nd. Oh, dear. How these things get started. Well, down to the real facts of life, not the alternative facts or the myths or the legends or things that can't be proven, even though they may be somehow entertaining. By the way, that was a great movie with Bill Murray in it, Groundhog Day. That was one of my personal favorites. Very romantic thing, too, to I might even have been released around Valentine's Day in the year that it was released. But it was Andy McDowell and Bill Murray. If you haven't seen it, something to watch together with a loved one, I think. Very romantic. But this Wednesday, it's the first time in my history, and I've lived in Dearborn since 1979. Oh, my gosh. So I'm not exactly a newbie, although many people think I am because I wasn't born here. we had an emergency town hall. Okay, now it wasn't sponsored by the city of Dearborn. It was sponsored by Access. Okay, the Arab Community Council for Education and Social Services, something like that. They don't really spell out what their acronym stands for anymore, and they don't have to. They're just a very good social service agency for all the people of Dearborn and the surrounding areas. And started by Ishmael Ahmed, of course, about 35 years ago, I believe. Well, here's the story. The emergency town hall in Dearborn, this is from the Press and Guide website, and it'll be in their paper this Sunday, no doubt. It informs public about controversial executive order from the president's office. And here's the story. Hundreds of people came together Wednesday for an emergency town hall meeting held by Access and Take on Hate, the organization Take on Hate, to address, and Take on Hate means let's stop it, okay? Take it on by confronting it and stopping it, okay? Doing things to undo hatred. Anyway, they wanted to address concerns to the community about the temporary immigrant travel ban put into place last week by President Donald Trump. The executive order, which bans immigration from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Sudan, and Yemen, has been under fire from many since it was signed January 27th and was a heated topic at the emergency town hall in Dearborn this last Wednesday. And of course, Dearborn is a city with one of the highest Arab American populations in the United States. And there's a picture here, a photo that they took. I assume it's not a stock photo. It's one they actually took this Wednesday evening. There's some signs up, but I can't quite read them. But I assume they took that picture Wednesday evening. The auditorium is filled. When was the last time that the auditorium would be filled? Pretty amazing. Pretty strange. Yep. See, there's someone knocking on the door of the station, and there's no one here to let that person in. Oh, there is someone. Okay, good, good. He's asking a question. He was looking through the window here. We have our studios in the Student Center at Henry Ford College main campus, and people can watch us. Yeah, like monkeys in a cage. Well, not necessarily. They can watch us through our big picture windows. Soundproof, by the way, so don't start yelling obscenities. We can't hear you. Sorry. You won't be going over the air. And it's always great to have people, taking note of us, okay, as well as listening to us. Tell all your friends that there is a local news show about Dearborn and the surrounding area every Friday from 1 to 2 and available as a podcast from our website anytime, whfr.fm. And there's one new one added every week. And the old ones are still there, by the way, in case you missed last week. You can go and listen by just clicking on the appropriate date under Talk Shows, WHFR Journal, and then select the date you want. Today is, of course, February the 3rd. So I was just saying about the crowded auditorium is that the large auditorium at the so-called Guido Theater, not so-called, it is called, it is named the Guido Theater at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. It's filled. When was the last time it was filled? Now, maybe I would hope for some, you know, Dearborn Symphony performance, but usually not quite filled. The last time that there was a State of the City address, and I'll get to that as our next story, it was only about half filled. Okay, open to the public, all the people of Dearborn, and it was only half filled. I think John, our mayor, John B. O'Reilly Jr., he did, that was about 3 years ago, 4 years ago was the last time that they used the Guido Theater for it. And it was only about half filled. So this was a big turnout. This is a very important issue. I was speaking to the mayor's office yesterday about a couple of the things as a journalist. And mayor's very busy these days. I bet he's doing phone interviews with radio stations all over the country, since we do have that largest population, or one of the largest, they say, of immigrants from the Middle East anywhere in this country. Anyway, he was extremely busy, and this was the issue. Now, he didn't, according to the story, he didn't speak. Asha Noor, advocacy and civil engagement specialist for the National Network for Arab American Communities, spoke to the crowd. She said, these executive orders will affect our Latino brothers and sisters. They will affect our African-American brothers and sisters, both Muslim and non-Muslim, and many other groups in these countries, or in this country, because of all the countries that are banned at this point. She says, this is a time to protect each other, unquote. Noor was joined on stage by Abed Ayoub, who is a national and legal director for the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, Khaled Beydoun, professor of law at the University of Detroit Mercy, and Noel Saleh, who is a member of the Arab Community Center, well, there it is, ACCESS, Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services. We got the acronym out there. And Mr. Saleh has been with the board since 1989. One by one, the speakers stepped up to the podium, asking the audience for help fighting back against an order that has affected so many. Beydoun said, I want to focus on making this talk a call to action. And he read a passage from James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, a book reflecting on the Jim Crow laws in the 1960s, as he made a connection between current issues and the issues in those faced by blacks only a half century ago. You're not alone in your fear, he said to the crowd. Channel your fear into action. Convert that fear into courage, because if Muslims don't fight for Muslims, then nobody else will. Well, I think that, I don't think that's accurate. I think even if Muslims are afraid to speak out for fear that they might be punished, there's a lot of other good people in the world, in this community, and I would be one of them with my little radio show here, to say that that was unfair and that's inappropriate activity by the president's office and by the government in the United States of America. And I am saying that. And by the way, all opinions expressed in this show are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford College, faculty, staff, students, administrators, board of trustee members. Okay? But we thank them, of course, all for allowing us our ability to speak them. Try to do it in a somewhat a balanced way, of course. But I'm reading opinions, of course, from the meeting this last Wednesday. The crowd heard Mr. Beydoun's call to action and erupted into applause at almost every chance they got in support of the professor, who was in, as he called it, preacher mode. Saleh, an attorney who specializes in civil liberties and immigration law, was last to address the crowd during the emergency town hall. He is nationally recognized as a leading immigrant advocate, according to ACCESS's website. He said, quote, this is an important part of civic engagement. This is what is going going to enable us to challenge and defeat the assault of all of our civil liberties, the assault on all of our civil liberties. And that was in reflecting on the overwhelmingly large number of attendees packing the auditorium. Oh, I will say that I went to the Bernie Sanders rally when he was campaigning here in Michigan, and he did win, you know, the Democratic primary last year for president of the United States, although, of course, he didn't win the Democratic Party nomination, finally. Nonetheless, that was a packed auditorium, too. Standing room only, definitely. Salah made a point not only to talk about the immigration executive order, but to address all the orders made by the new president, showing concerns for each one. I think there was 20 executive orders in the first day, which is, there's always irony here with politics. 2 years ago, the Republicans in the U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C. were complaining because President Obama used an executive order for something. How dare you? Executive orders, doing that, that's unconstitutional. Well, it's not, of course, but that's what they said then. It turned out that even at that point, 6 years into his term of two terms of office, President Obama used executive orders less than George W. Bush did. And now I think Donald Trump has probably beaten both their records. Or if he hasn't yet, he sure will. 20 executive orders in 10 days. That sounds like something like a dictator would do. In other words, dictator gives an order and everybody falls in line. And no need for Congress or voting or... we don't need that. We're a democracy, a representative democracy. We have three branches of government, and it's just not what we got into here. Not and ours is a great concept, has worked for many, many long years, and we don't need a dictator. Again, Mussolini in the 1930s, head of Italy, he made the trains run on time. Yeah. Not much else that was good, though. And Adolf Hitler, well, we know about him. He was democratically elected, and then he said, hey, why don't the government just turn around and appoint me a chancellor for life because I'm so popular? The hell with, you know, the rest of the Constitution in Germany and voting. Just get it done with, you know. And they did by 1933. So he was chancellor for life. Why? Because he asked for it. Why? Because he was so popular. And that was the end of any democracy at that point in Germany. And we know what happened with his initiatives, right? Most dictators, when they get that absolute power, they go absolutely nuts. And I'm paraphrasing, or I'm generalizing, of course. But okay, so once Saleh was finished this Wednesday night, members of the community here in Dearborn were given the chance to approach the microphone and ask the speakers for advice on what they should do next. Many raised their concerns about everything from their legal rights to inviting people to a number of protests around metropolitan Detroit. Mohammed Al-Mawa, an Iraq native currently living in Dearborn, was one of the people who attended the event at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. According to him, the executive order the president signed into place is something that must be dealt with right away. He said, this order is affecting everyone, and it's important we learn how we're going to deal with all that is happening. We really need to fix everything that's going on so that it doesn't get any worse than it's already become. So that was a big deal in Dearborn. Probably was covered on the commercial media. I hope it was. And it's easy to understand why residents' community, and I would hope residents of most every community, would be very concerned about the, criticize me in your mind, but do your research, abuse of power to do executive orders on things that are borderline illegal. So what do we do in America other than protest and wave signs? Well, I'm just reaching for the story here. Pregnant pause, as they say. What's that silence? Did he fall over dead? No. No, I'm just grabbing the story. Dearborn-based ACRL, this is from the Press and Guide News on their website from February 1st. The American Arab Civil Rights League announced the filing of a federal lawsuit on behalf of several of its members challenging the constitutionality of President Donald Trump's executive order on immigration. And so that lawsuit was filed Wednesday again, well, before the town meeting, in the U.S. District Court, Eastern District of Michigan, alleges that the order is unconstitutional because it bans Muslims and Arabs from Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. That it is a Muslim ban, in effect, de facto. Especially since, you know, there's, well, just anyone living in that country. No. There's a little exemption for minority religions can come from those countries. What would be a minority religion in a majority Muslim country? Well, for one, Christians. Ooh, if you're Christian, you're bound to be a good person. That's patently false too. It's not necessarily completely true. You can't make a generalization like that. I think it can be pointed out, if you look through the history books, that there are many Christians who have been serial killers of one sort or the other. Bad people, okay? And so just because you say or you affiliate somehow with a religious group doesn't mean you're going to be a good person. And that goes for every religion. I'm sorry, it does. And you can look it up. There's always exceptions, that there are bad people everywhere of all kinds of religions. And what's interesting, of course, is that the factual reality of terrorists either being part of refugees, and that's different than just immigrants. Not much, but, you know, a refugee is someone who is desperate, in need, impoverished, because in their specific country, such as Syria, they can't live there anymore. You know, the complete country has been destroyed, infrastructure gone, education gone, bullets flying still, bombs going off still, drones flying around. It's you just want to stay alive. You want to help your family grow and develop. And so, of course, lawsuits didn't just originate here in Dearborn, but originated all around the country. The Attorney General of the state of Washington, not Washington, D.C., but state of Washington, the Attorney General for that state has said he's filing suit for pretty much the same grounds in court against the U.S. government. They're going to try to refuse through their governmental system that sort of ban or activity in their state. In Michigan, of course, our good old Attorney General, Schulte, who wants to be the next governor, oh yeah, after Governor Snyder is term limited and can't serve beyond the end of next year, Schulte wants to be right there. He, of course, is totally agreeing with Donald Trump that Michigan should stop importing those refugees, even though Governor Snyder says, hey, as long as they're vetted, you know, and right now it takes quite a number of months. They don't just bus them up over in Syria, put them in a plane and send them over to us and drop them off, you know. Everybody goes through what's called vetting, and it's pretty intense. And the number of jihadists or terrorists who are part of the refugee groups is very small. Somebody said out of the last 800,000 over maybe 10 years that have come into this country, only 3 to 5, and I'm not sure why the difference in numbers here, took part in any violent activity. That's less, I think, than criminal activity for people that live in the United States. I mean, that's a very, very small percentage, a fraction of a percent. And of course, even though Canada just had an event in which several, I think 6 people were killed at a mosque that was bombed, was it Montreal or Quebec City? What was their response? Okay, obviously they're trying to find out who did it, if they don't already know. But as reported in the New York Times, whenever my voice gets low like that, I'm off mic, as they say, which is a bad thing. But this was yesterday, okay, Thursday, February 2nd. Canada's response to hate, more tolerance. Again, they just had a terrorist act that killed people. So it was an attack against Muslims who were worshiping quietly, peacefully, in their religious center, their mosque, in Quebec City. And here's the editorial from the New York Times. No society is immune to acts of terrorism, especially by a lone wolf driven by deep hatreds. The United States has known many mass shootings. Norway had the mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik. In France last July, a man drove a truck into a crowd in Nice, killing dozens. The list could go on and on. When they strike, the measure of a wounded society is how it responds. On Sunday, Quebec City was struck when officials say a 27-year-old student named Alexandra Bissonnette, known to be a right-wing extremist, walked into, I think in the U.S. you'd call them alt-right. He walked into a mosque, began shooting, and killed six people. The shock across Canada was immediate and tangible. Tolerance, and this is their response, tolerance is a proud theme in Canadian identity. The country has taken in nearly 40,000 Syrian refugees since late 2015. I'm not even sure we approached the 10,000 number yet here in the U.S., by the way, when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau took office. Now Canadians were wondering how this could have happened and what it means, a question made more acute by their widespread revulsion at President Trump's actions to block Muslims from the United States. The response of Quebec's Premier, Philippe Couillard, is worth noting. Every society has to deal with demons, he said. Our society is not perfect. None is. These demons are named xenophobia, racism, exclusion. They are present here. We need to recognize that and act together to show the direction we want our society to evolve. Which I might go on to point out, he's implying it's not those ways. Okay. And the New York Times says that was what Canadians sought to do. Thousands gathered at memorial services across the country, including Trudeau on Monday. Speaking to Parliament, he addressed the more than 1 million Muslim Canadians. And he said, quote, 36 million hearts are breaking with yours. He said, referring to the population of Canada, know that we value you, unquote. In sad contrast, the reaction from Trump's White House was to use the shootings to justify its anti-immigrant policies. The attack was a terrible reminder, said the White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, of why America's actions must be, quote, proactive rather than reactive, unquote. The logic or illogic seemed to be that if Muslims had been kept out of Canada, they would not have been killed. Conclusion of the New York Times, Canada is not perfect. It, too, has its demons, as Couillard said. But Canada's commitment to inclusion was, if anything, strengthened. Last weekend, I remember a brief quote from Justin Trudeau when the ban went into effect and there was chaos in many of our large airports around the country that were accepting planes from these six, seven countries that are on the ban list now. And, of course, it wasn't implemented right. I mean, the Homeland Security, border guards, airport security, whatever. Nobody was informed. Everybody had different opinions. Everybody enforced it in different ways. What a mess, first of all. But Trudeau said, hey, if you're stuck in the airport and they want you to leave, come on to Canada. That's what he said. Come on to Canada. We'll work it out. You can land here. We'll let you in. Of course, we'll vet you, or, you know, we'll talk to you, we'll find out what's going on, but you can come here. Now that is generosity. That is human compassion. Okay. So thank you, Canada. If anybody's listening from Windsor or anywhere else in Canada to the podcast, thank you very much, Justin Trudeau, and all the statements and support for the terrible situation has resulted from some inappropriate decisions. I'm trying to use the least critical term here on the part of our new chief executive. Okay, let's get, what happened? I can't hear myself, but you can hear me, I believe. I just pulled out my microphone. I mean, my headphone. So hang on. Oh, there I am. Okay. Some news, Henry Ford College news. A good thing going from sad national and local upset. Henry Ford College Ice Carving Club places third in the National Ice Carving Association National Collegia, as it's called. This happened the weekend of January 28th. Their overall score at the Snowfest was 453.3. They were just edged out by Macomb Community College. which took second place with an overall score of 453.7. So it's 0.4 difference in points. Oakland Community College placed first with an overall score of 54.4. Still, that was only 1 point difference, 1.1 point difference from the Ice Carving Club. So they had three very good ice carving associations. In overall individual ratings, several of our ice carving people got credit. A Mark Tampakes, a Steve McCormick, in several categories. Robert Speaks and Jamie Slays, S-L-A-I-S, also got individual awards. Their advisor of the club is Jeffrey Lau, L-A-O, or Leo, if he pronounces it that way. Sorry, Jeffrey, I don't know which way you pronounce it. But he said, our students competed against other collegiate ice carvers from around the country. They performed very well and took third place overall. I'm very proud of their efforts and dedication. And, of course, that's a special, those are special classes within the culinary arts program at Henry Ford College, which is a four-year degree program. Now, yes, you stay here in 4 years. You'll have a degree, a bachelor, is it of arts or science? A bachelor degree in science, in culinary and hospitality studies, and if you want to stay with us for all 4 years. Of course, our ice carving club started as a club, my goodness, a dozen or more years ago, which was sponsored by one of the instructors of the culinary arts program at that time. But now, because part of the four-year degree, too, it's actually a class you can take, as well as a club that expands, or like WHFR was a club and has expanded now into a sponsored activity, a completely, as you realize, licensed FM radio station. But congratulations to them. We know they're great. As I walk into the Student Center, that is also known as Student Center and Culinary Arts Center, here at the main campus of Henry Ford College, M building, the most important building, M building, okay, is they often, if the temperature is right, right outside the south entrance to our student center, they have worked on carvings, usually on Wednesday and Thursday nights. You know, they had to practice, of course, and learn their craft. And beautiful things, absolutely beautiful things, not just, you know, simple little statues. We're talking about eagles and, fantastic fictional creatures, too. They do a great job. So that's the Ice Carving Club. Congratulations. Third place, but, you know, very close to first place. And really great program, which is part of the larger program here at Henry Ford College. All right. Ooh, halfway through the hour, so it's time to give Jay's voice a break. Here's that comment that started the show. Just so you hear this, this is a new representative who's a Republican from Michigan, who has taken up a cause that started with Dan Kildee out of Flint, primarily worried about contamination of Lake Erie. Now, Lake Huron, yes, first, and then Lake Erie later, and the Detroit River, too, by the Bruce Nuclear Power Plant in Ontario. They want to bury more wastes not far away from the lake. And, you know, there's so many people that depend on the freshwater, and specifically these two great lakes, including all of us here in Dearborn, that we don't want it contaminated. So we can't drink the water for 100,000 years. That would destroy the whole area, and that's the problem. And you say, well, it's just one nuclear plant. No, there's six of them, and a couple are already out of service. And oh my gosh, there's a whole bunch of them over there. So I mean, there's also other dangers because of all those nuclear plants all close together. But the storage problem is critical, and they're doing it all above ground right now, and circulating pools of water, trying to keep it cool, but that's not working. They can't last forever. They want to put it buried underground. Well, of course, underground, anything underground might not stay totally underground. It might, what they call, leach or seep into the lake underground after a few years. Maybe sooner rather than later, maybe later rather than sooner, but sometime it will. And so we don't want to take that chance. So here's the report, and it is, it's 5 minutes, but it's worth hearing that this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is not a question of climate change, because it is changing. There's no question about climate change anyway, and that humans are primarily the cause. Give me a break here. Okay, this is not something that's disputed. And this Republican representative is now part of almost all the representatives from the eastern side of Michigan that are trying to get Canada's attention through Congress. And here's a report from Michigan Public Radio.
Ontario Power Generation, OPG, is determined to build an underground storage bunker for nuclear waste less than a mile from Lake Huron. Michigan's congressional delegation has been objecting to this project in Kincardine, Ontario, every step of the way. Now, with a new year and a new administration in the White House, come fresh efforts. Paul Mitchell is the new Republican congressman from Michigan's 10th District. He and other Michigan members of Congress have asked President Trump to pressure Canada to block the OPG proposal. And he is a co-signer on another letter that was sent to new Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs. Congressman Paul Mitchell, welcome to Stateside.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for talking with me.
Now, you've put a letter together and gotten other Michigan members of Congress to sign it, asking President Trump to do exactly what?
Well, we've asked him to engage with Prime Minister Trudeau and address the issue there, move it to a location, move their dump to a location that is outside the Great Lakes Basin. And in the letter, we were able to get 13 total members of Congress from multiple states. It's a bipartisan letter, asking them to move forward and address with the Canadians the location of that disposal site.
There was also a letter you co-signed that was sent to the new Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs, representatives of Great Lakes states. This truly is bipartisan. As I looked through the signatories, there's no either side of the aisle on this one.
Oh, no. The Great Lakes is a source of drinking water for about 40 million people. It makes up one-fifth of the world's freshwater supply. Any risk to the Great Lakes whatsoever is a significant problem, whatever way you measure it. And a country the size of Canada, we have to be able to find a location that doesn't risk that drinking water. It's a massive issue.
We've talked on Stateside about the fact that OPG recently submitted a required report to Canada's government. And just to recap, saying in essence, hey, we looked around. There are no other suitable sites. Moving the location would add $5.5 billion to the cost of this project. And by the way, if we did build somewhere else, it would mean tens of thousands of truck shipments of radioactive waste along the highways. And then finally, I'll quote here, there is little interest among the general public regarding the project. What do you say to those arguments?
Well, I'm not sure. $5.5 billion may well be the case, and that may be the most pressing issue that they're talking about, frankly. Yes, it costs money. It will cost money to do anything that puts it in another location. But how do you measure the cost of safe drinking water for that number of people? How do you make that comparison? Suggest that there isn't any interest. I don't know. It took me all of 4 days to collect the signatures of that members of Congress to send a letter to the Trump administration. And as you know, around Washington, some things don't move very quickly, but that was a pretty simple thing to do. There's a great deal of interest. And I think if you check the people around the Great Lakes in Canada, they'd be concerned too.
And I note that there was an attachment to the letter sent to the Canadian minister with a list of the 186 local county and state governments that represent what nearly 23 million people on both sides of the border, U.S. and Canada.
Sure.
Do you expect a different approach from the Trump administration to this issue than perhaps the Obama administration took?
Well, I think that one thing you can say for President Trump is he expresses himself in a very direct manner. So I don't believe that they would be quite as vague in terms of our concerns. There's a lot of things, obviously, on the plate at the White House. I can't speak for them, but I certainly can say that I certainly hope they bring this matter up. I've had the chance through some meetings to talk with a couple of members of the Canadian delegation here, and have mentioned it to them as well, and we'll continue to push this issue.
And what's your take on their response and their receptiveness to American concerns?
I think more importantly, and that's why I appreciate Congressman Kildee's letter, the attachment he provided, which included a lot of municipalities along the Great Lakes in Canada, I think that's even more important to them when they hear from all these municipalities over there saying, wait a minute, what are you talking about? How can you say there's minimal risk? This is not an issue we can risk.
Congressman, what are you telling people who are opposed to this project to do? What's the best course of action for concerned citizens?
Well, I'd suggest that they contact their member of Congress. They send a letter to the White House asking them to engage. I know there are a number of Canadians that do hear Michigan Radio. I would suggest that they contact their government and they say, folks, we can't play how big a risk game with the Great Lakes. Besides our drinking water, the recreational and business impacts, that would be massive. And there's got to be, in this country the size of Canada, a better place to put this than a couple of miles off Lake Huron. Come on, guys. I mean, let's be realistic about this.
Paul Mitchell is the Republican representative from Michigan's 10th Congressional District. Congressman, thank you so much for taking our questions today.
Thanks for talking with you. Have a good day.
And we thank Michigan Public Radio for allowing us to rebroadcast that. Actually, it's out there on their website, michiganradio.org, and anybody can listen to the podcast or download it who wants to. That's great. Let's get the news out there. And I just thought that was a point in fact. This is many environmental issues. All Republicans, Democrats, Green Party, Libertarians, they will agree on the need to keep our environment in good shape. Whether it's air, water, pollution of more sorts that are common, or nuclear radiation, that we cause, that we have direct control over, too. We got to do that. By the way, on an environmental note, I meant to say this a couple months ago. Let's see, the story is actually from, just a month ago, January 21st this year, 2017. It was on commondreams.org, another great website of news that you won't hear anywhere else, and not fake news, people, okay. For the third year in a row, the world experienced its warmest year on the books, global scientists have determined. Okay, the new assessments come from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, N-O-A-A, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, you've heard of them, the space people, and the UK, that is United Kingdom's Met Office, it's called the Met Office, M-E-T, as well as the World Meteorological Organization, WMO. And so these findings all back up the declaration made earlier this month by the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service. The quote is, 2016 is remarkably the third record year in a row in this series. We don't expect record years every year, but the ongoing long-term warming trend is clear. There you go. Uh-huh. And I do think in Michigan this year, and it's just, you know, anecdotal, as they say, just my subjective opinion. Is that an alternative fact? Well, in a way. But Michigan's winter in the Detroit area has been relatively warm. I know it's kind of cold today. It's in the low 20s for a high. But off and on, we're back up in the 40s again. And there's only really been three snowfalls that I've had to shovel. One was last November or December. It was unusually early. About a week ago, what was it, about 2 or 3 inches? But it was, because it was warm, the temperature was in the high 20s. It was very wet. It was very heavy. It was very slushy. Boy, it was a real pain to shovel that off my driveway, I know, because it was so heavy. If it was just 2 or 3 inches of fluffy, powdery snow, you know, snow blower, take it away. But this was heavy, heavy snow because it was so damp and wet. That was because it was so warm. Okay. So I don't think we've had much of a winter in Michigan. And in saying that, I know tomorrow might be really terrible. It's supposed to actually be in the 30s tomorrow, maybe low 30s, but not too bad. All right. The environment here. Just update on saving the groundwater that we've covered now and then. The environmental group is demanding that Nestle have hearings in Flint and Detroit. Nestle is the company that owns the Ice Mountain problem. And right now they're only going to have a hearing in Big Rapids, Michigan. But they want the state of Michigan to approve pumping more, that they're pumping out more water out of Michigan for its bottling operations, where it makes tons of profit and they don't give anything back and they're not paying us anything for the water. They want to take 400 gallons a minute from one well in particular, every minute of every hour of every day. That's approximately 210 million gallons a year. If granted, this permit will cost the Nestle Corporation a $200 fee. That's it. or less than a $1 per million gallons of fresh water. And how much do you pay at the store to buy Ice Mountain water? Personally, I have to tell you, I boycott. I do not buy. Well, I try not to buy water in plastic bottles, except when I have to, when there's no other choice. But certainly not Ice Mountain, because it's our water. It's our Michigan water, and they're not paying anything for it, and they're charging us as much as anybody else on water that comes from Fiji in the Pacific, Fiji Islands, or a mineral water area, in Perrier in France. Pretty expensive water. Well, Ice Mountain is almost as expensive, not quite as much as Perrier, which is carbonated also. I mean, it's naturally carbonated, but what the heck. And it looks like they're not going to do hearings anywhere else except Big Rapids, where most people who are concerned, and all of us in Michigan should be concerned, because it sets a very bad example that our groundwater, which is for the use of Michigan, I believe, Michigan people, not corporations primarily, is just being siphoned off. Because once it's gone, folks. You get that? Yeah, I guess you get that. Okay. Who was the first major U.S. automaker to oppose Donald Trump's travel ban last weekend? Ford Motor Company. Thank you, CEO Mark Fields, and thank you, Executive Chairman Bill Ford. They said that their company, Ford Motor, does not support Trump's policy, quote, or any other that goes against our values as a company, unquote. Well, of course, you realize that Ford Motor Company is a multinational company, headquartered in Dearborn, but still, they have an awful lot of companies, and they sell cars in almost every civilized country in the world, and they will even sell to Muslims. That's a joke. That's a satire. But yes, anybody, okay? And so they don't discriminate. Because they'll lose money. Think about it. That's where discrimination really hurts, when it loses money for you. And why should they? Why should they get a reputation for being in favor of discrimination? Then those whole groups of people will boycott them, like I'm boycotting Ice Mountain water. All right? So it makes perfect business sense. Donald Trump, take note, that multinational corporations based in the U.S. that pay a lot of U.S. taxes still, they are not in favor of this whole concept. And there's all kinds of other terrible reasons that make this ban terrible. Yes, he promised to do it. Yes, people voted for him. Many people voted for him because he promised to have this ban. But he was exaggerating, folks, about the need. In fact, I believe you could say he was lying, almost, about the need. Exaggerations for the sake of getting elected. A lot of politicians do that. And then they don't do the same thing when they get in office. They get a little more rational and professional and sensible. And that hasn't happened yet. But thank you, Ford Motor Company, for that. Another late breaking news this week. This is from the newsherald.com website. Probably be in their paper this weekend. GM and Honda partnership. New partnership between General Motors and the Honda Motor Company. They're going to invest $48 million in a private manufacturing investment in Brownstown Township. And that's going to bring in 100 new jobs. And I did the math there. $48 million spent. That's $480,000 per job. Why do you think so few jobs for a $48 million investment? And the answer is robots, automation, of course. And it's just the way of the future, folks. And what are they going to do there, by the way? They're going to work together. Because GM can't do it alone, not smart enough. Actually, they don't have all the preliminary research that Honda does. Honda's been working on this particular propulsion system for cars for quite a few years now, and GM really hasn't. So they're going to work together. So GM's actually buying the know-how of Honda and then maybe getting a special deal from them to use some of the knowledge about these propulsion systems in their future cars. And what is it? Fuel cell technology. Hydrogen fuel cells, okay? And you need special pumps installed in various places to fill up, if you will, use that term, these fuel cells. But it's very clean for the environment, and nobody exactly knows what's going to be the way of the future. I do think fuel cells are quite a few years away, but they're doing this research. They say in the story that they might begin being used in vehicles starting in 2020. Well, my goodness, 3 years away. But very pricey, I understand. Nothing like just plugging in an electric car into your wall socket at home or in your garage and having it be ready to go the next morning. Nothing like that. So we'll see where that goes. But just another great investment there. The Michigan Strategic Fund, and this has got to be a misprint, approved a $2 grant request for the project. A $2 grant? What the heck? I don't think the Michigan Strategic Fund would just give you $2 towards it. So a little typo there. I suspect it might be another $2 million. I don't know. Just guessing. Who knows? We'll straighten that out someday. All right, so it's about 10 minutes to go before the Best in the Blues Highway 61 comes up, and that'll be hosted today by Mike Holloway, whose own show, Go With the Flow. Mike Holloway is going to be from 4 to 6 right after that. So Mike is really going with the flow today, the Best in the Blues, for 4 straight hours. Kitty Love is still a little bit under the weather. She's fighting a serious infection, but we hope those should get back to us really quickly here on Friday. But Best in the Blues coming up in just 10 minutes. Okay, here's a comment from Jack Lessenberry. He went to a conference. This is from a week ago, I think January 27th, he recorded this, but important. We always talk about, we talk from the local papers, mainly from their news sites, because it's more up to date than the papers that are printed. But here is his commentary about newspapers being in trouble today.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. I'm in Grand Rapids today at the annual convention of the Michigan Press Association, which represents daily and weekly newspapers throughout the state. It's largely a happy event. Those gathered celebrate and award prizes to some of the best journalism in the state. This year's top winner was an investigation in which the Detroit News revealed that dirty surgical equipment was being used in operating rooms at a major hospital. Old friends reconnect here, as they do at all conventions, and a certain amount of alcohol may or may not be drunk. I had the privilege of being here with Addie Wallace, one of our star Wayne State journalism students, who won a scholarship, as did other fine students from around the state. Yet the profession they're thinking about entering is in serious trouble. Newspaper jobs across America declined by a whopping 40% between 1994 and 2014, and have fallen further since. Newspaper circulation is barely half of what it was half a century ago, when the population was considerably smaller. The Detroit News, which had 670,000 print subscribers 30 years ago, has fewer than 50,000 today. What's worse from a revenue standpoint is that not only has traditional print advertising been in freefall, digital or online advertising in American newspapers has also been falling slightly, according to industry figures and the Pew Research Center. As a result, many newspapers have died altogether, and others are a mere shadow of their former selves. Many people aren't the least concerned and might regard this essay as an irrelevant flight of nostalgia for obsolete technology. After all, doesn't everyone get news online now, often on their phones? Why, yes, they do. But most of the news they get, especially news with any depth, is taken from newspapers. The very medium, the Internet, has been inadvertently working to kill. Yes, you can get wonderful disaster photos from a kid on the scene with a smartphone. But you need trained journalists to not only find out inconvenient truths, but explain how complex issues and proposed policy changes will affect you. The new administration in Washington is proposing some of the most radical changes we've seen in our lifetimes, in everything from health care to trade policy. Try figuring out what this would mean to you and your family from bulletins on your cell phone. Michigan Radio does an amazing job, especially if you access the resources on our website. But we can't cover everything. We'll hold the city council in Holly or Holland responsible every week. Virtually all internet news is collected from traditional news sources, mostly newspapers. If they all die, you'll be able to find a lot of pictures of Donald Trump and Jennifer Aniston. I don't know, frankly, how to save newspapers. The model for some may be what happened with the Washington Post, which was bought by Amazon mogul Jeff Bezos, who's been pouring money into it and making it better. What I do know is that real democracy is probably impossible without newspapers. You have a few thousand people in the state who are working long hours for lousy salaries and insecure jobs to bring you information you need. I think they deserve admiration and respect.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
And we thank, again, Michigan Public Radio for allowing Jack Lessenberry's commentary here on WHFR.FM. I do subscribe to the Dearborn Press and Guide and the Dearborn Times Herald. And then I just primarily use mostly their websites. The Dearborn Times Herald doesn't really have a website that I can go to directly, but the Downriver News Herald does. And but nonetheless, if you don't support what's left of our weekly local newspapers, they'll be gone soon. And I do not just subscribe to the Free Press of the News. They have declined in their resources and usefulness. Neither one of them has a full-time Lansing reporter. I think that's important. And the only people that have a full-time Lansing reporter to keep us in touch with what's happening in state government is Michigan Public Radio. Duh. Okay. Let's see. Oh, I also subscribe to the New York Times, but only the Sunday edition, because it's a great summary of what's happened in the last week. Great sections on many separate topics, too. Economics, arts and literature, and sports, of course, and many things. And so, it's hard to keep up these days. You can't trust your necessarily. Don't get your news from Facebook, for Pete's sake. Don't get your news from Twitter. Don't get your news from social media. Most of the time, it's just not verifiable, okay? And it's usually an exaggeration or a quick thought that doesn't have enough support behind it to make it worthwhile. In fact, in terms of Twitter, I don't think any really good, sensible idea about anything can be expressed in 140 characters. So I don't use it. So don't, Kornick, why aren't you tweeting? Because, look, I've only got 3 minutes left in this hour, and I'm still talking. How could I tweet in 140 characters? I've got too much to say. Oh. Okay. What else we got here? And he turns away from a second. Okay. Real briefly, we talk every now and then about the suicide epidemic, and I know we did at the end of last year, but I just want you to know, out of the 30,000-plus gun deaths each year here in America, that's 30,000 out of 300-plus million. So that's not, I mean, that's still a lot. Okay. But there are 60% of those 30,000-plus, that's more than 18,000 each year, are acts of suicide. Not accidents or homicidal attacks, which is the other portion. So only 40% of our suicides each year are accidents or homicidal attacks, but with guns. But 60% are suicides, people taking their own lives with guns. Does that change your idea about gun control or gun violence? I don't know, but those are the facts. And that's suicide continues rising. And we report on it every now and then because something needs to be done. Okay. 2 minutes to go. Summary here briefly. Thomas J. Friedman is an economist who writes articles for the New York Times. On Wednesday, January 25th, he wrote an editorial opinion. And he says, I've been watching the early Trump presidency from London. Even from here, I have vertigo. He was in London, England. My head is swirling from, quote, alternative facts, unquote. Trade deals canceled, pipelines initiated, Obamacare in the Twilight Zone, and rants about attendance on Inauguration Day and fake voters on Election Day. Whatever this costs Vladimir Putin, he's already gotten his money's worth. A chaos president. But moderate Republicans, independents, and Democrats who oppose Trump need to beware. He can make you so nuts that you can't think clearly about the most important questions today. What things are true, even if Donald Trump believes them, and therefore merit support? And where can Democrats offer smarter approaches on issues like jobs? Approaches that can connect to the guts of working class voters as Trump did. Where Trump's instinct is not wrong is on the need to strike a better trading arrangement with China. But I worry about his tactics. I would be negotiating with Beijing in total secret. Let everybody save face. Saving face is a very important concept if you study Chinese culture at all. He says, Friedman goes on to say, where I think Democrats should focus their fresh thinking is on how we actually bring back more middle-class jobs. If Trump's bullying can actually save good jobs, God bless him. But what Trump doesn't see is that while this may get him some short-term job headlines, in the long run, CEOs may prefer not to build their next factory in America precisely because it will be hostage to Trump's Twitter lashings. They also may quietly replace more workers with robots faster, as we've suggested on this show, as we've given evidence to the fact, because Trump, Friedman says, can't see or complain about that. So take a look. You can look up Thomas L. Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. You can search for all of his opinions on nytimes.com. Always worthy of not following per se, but of challenging yourself with a variety of ideas, and we hope you get those from the new WHFR Journal every week. We hope you come back next Friday. Oh, big news. I don't think I said it before, and I got to get it out today. There will be no State of the City address by Mayor O'Reilly. That's right. For the first year in ever, I think, Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. will not be giving a State of the City address. I'll tell you more about that next week, but I just found that out last week, and I thought you might want to know. Okay, so be talking to you more next week. Take care out there. This is WHFR Dearborn. Stay tuned for Highway 61 with Mike Holloway.
Afternoon. This is WHFR Dearborn. You're listening to the program known as Highway 61.